God, and God is one who will faithfully rescue us and take care of us. Go perfectly with our topic tonight as we think about God as an angry God. Sort of. I did suggest to Charlie that we rewrite the song Awesome God to be Angry God, but he didn't go for that, so he sang songs of God's love and dependence instead, and that is, of course, ultimately where we're going to be winding up. We've been working for a couple of lessons now in a series of lessons on how God is so sometimes stereotyped by people in particular who don't know the Bible that well. They may think they know the Bible that well, and in particular, they know some negative sorts of passages pretty well. And those also happen to be quite frequently passages that we like to avoid because we're not quite sure what to do with them. And it leaves us in a bit of a bind because sometimes, to the watching world, the skeptic knows more about our Bible than we do when we don't spend time thinking about these kinds of issues. And so last time we kind of introduced this topic and talked about a few different things related to it. And this really draws out of a lesson I did initially as a standalone lesson back in the fall where we talked about the question of whether God wants us to be happy or not in God's laws and are they burdensome to us and those kinds of things. But I do want to move today to talk about this issue of God's character. Is God an angry God or is God a loving God? And in particular, the idea of the God of the Old Testament, if again we can use that term accommodatively because we understand what people mean when they say that, even if we don't buy into that distinction, that this God of the Old Testament is a God of anger. This is the God that, specializes in smiting people. And we talked last time about a variety of different sorts of pop culture images of that idea of God being a smiting sort of God. And probably you've been in a conversation, or if you're like me, you've done this very thing where somebody says something that you're a little bit uncomfortable with until you take a big step backward because the implication being that he's about to be struck by lightning or something along those lines, because this is this image that we have sometimes of God. And we've talked in a different lesson about the wrath of God as it is presented in the Old Testament. And so I don't want to retread all of that ground that we've covered before, but let me remind you of a couple of things that we've said about the anger of God from this sort of perspective. And in particular, where you have to begin as you think about this issue is the book of Exodus in chapter 34. Because in Exodus chapter 34, we find a verse that becomes something of a refrain for the rest of the Old Testament. In Exodus chapter 34, here is where Moses has previously asked God to see his glory. And God reveals his glory in some sense. And in this case, in Exodus chapter 34 and verse 6, he reveals to him his name and his character. The Lord, that being the name of God. Yahweh, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation. And in another passage, you read that he will forgive for thousands of generations as well. But this first statement in particular, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love, becomes something of a refrain for the rest of the Old Testament. And what's really remarkable about it is that this shows up everywhere, really, in every sort of context imaginable. It shows up in historical books like Numbers chapter 14, where Moses is pleading with God to forgive his people, and in his plea, he quotes God's character back to God and says, God, this is who you are. This is who you have shown me you are. And in Nehemiah, in the prayer in Nehemiah chapter 9, it's the same thing, an appeal to God on the basis of his character, that he is this God who is slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. You find it in the prophets as well, in Joel chapter 2 and in Nahum chapter 1. In fact, in Jonah, the hope of the Ninevites is this, and the hope of the Ninevites is the consternation of Jonah himself, because he doesn't want them to be forgiven, and he knows that God is this very sort of God. And it shows up all over the Psalter as well, in the poetic section. So whether it's history or prophecy or poetry, this refrain is constant in the Old Testament, that when you think of God's anger, and again, this is the Old Testament God, and these are the people that know God best. When they think of God's anger, what they say is, He is a God who is slow to anger, is what they say. It's also emphasized that His anger is short-lived as well. In Isaiah chapter 54, God says here in verses 7 and 8, "For a brief moment I deserted you, but with great compassion I will gather you. In overflowing anger for a moment I hid my face from you. But with everlasting love I will have compassion on you." And notice that contrast, that back and forth. A brief moment I deserted you. In overflowing anger for a moment. But with everlasting love, by contrast, I will have compassion on you. Over in Jeremiah chapter 3. And verse 12, "Go and proclaim these words to the north and say, 'Return, faithless Israel,' declares the Lord. 'I will not look on you in anger, for I am merciful,' declares the Lord. 'I will not be angry forever.'" It is a short-lived anger that God has in the prophetic context. And you find the same thing in Psalm 103. Psalm 103, verses 8 through 14. Here, David says, "The Lord is merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love." That sounds familiar, doesn't it? That's that passage right out of Exodus 34 again. "He does not always chide, nor will He keep His anger forever. He does not deal with us according to our sins, nor repay us according to our iniquities. For as high as the heavens are above the earth, so great is His steadfast love to those who fear Him. As far as the east is from the west, so far does He remove our transgressions from us. As a father shows compassion to his children, so the Lord shows compassion on those who fear Him. For He knows our frame. He remembers that we are dust." The anger is slow to come and short-lived when it does. That is the Old Testament depiction of the anger of God. And again, it is the Old Testament where God gets this bad reputation for being a God of anger. Well, what do we do with it? I mean, where do we see it? Where does this idea come from? Well, we'll consider a couple of examples of this. But let me show you first one place where God gets angry that I think is instructive to us as we think about this. And it's back in Exodus chapter 3. If you want to turn over there for a moment. In Exodus chapter 3, here is God's conversation with Moses. Moses has, killed an Egyptian and run for his life and been with the Midianites. And now he's come back home, so to speak. And God calls to him out of the burning bush. And God says to him in Exodus chapter 3 and verse 10, "Come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring out my people, the children of Israel out of Egypt." So as you remember, Israel has been enslaved by the Egyptians and brutalized by the Egyptians, and this Pharaoh in particular. This Pharaoh has engaged in male infanticide. He has killed all of the baby boys to try to keep down the number of the Israelites and keep them oppressed. The Israelites have cried out to God, and He has heard their groans, and He has remembered His covenant with Abraham, and He is now beginning to act on that to deliver them. And He calls Moses and says, "Moses, you are my chosen instrument to deliver my people." And Moses says, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? No, God, I don't think I can do that. Really think that's beyond me. I'm just this shepherd from over yonder. Who am I that I should do this?" And God says, you don't worry about who you are, you worry about who I am. I will go with you. I will be with you. And you will lead these people out. And Moses says to God, yeah, but if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? What am I going to say? So first he says, who am I that I should do this? And then he says, who are you? And again, he's still not doing what God has asked him to do at all in this context. And so God gives him an answer to that as well. I'm the God of your fathers. I'm the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And he has a covenant with us and he is going to deliver us. And then you get down to chapter 4 and verse 1. And Moses says in response to all of this, but they're not going to listen to me. They're not going to believe what I have to say. And God says, well, here's how you can prove that, in fact, I am the one who sent you and gives him miracles to perform, to verify his identity. And then Moses says in verse 10, oh, my Lord, I am not eloquent, either in the past or since you have spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and tongue, and slow of faith as well, it seems. I can't do this. Who am I? Who are you? They're not going to believe me. I can't speak well. And God says, well, you don't worry about that. First of all, I'm the one who made man's mouth. Don't you think I can give you the words to speak? And beyond that, you know what? Take your brother with you. He'll speak for you. You don't even have to worry about this whole talking thing that you're so upset about. And you get down to verse 13. And in response to this, Moses says, oh, my Lord, please send someone else. Who am I? Who are you? They won't listen. I can't do it. Please pick someone else. Verse 14, then the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses. You don't say, right? I don't know about you, but probably on the second excuse is when I would have gotten angry. God withholds his anger for quite a while. And God very graciously listens. And God graciously offers solutions to the first four objections before he finally gets angry. But let me offer you three quick observations about this text. First of all, God doesn't smite Moses. You know, all of this talk about lightning coming down from heaven and God smiting and God killing and God sending pestilence and all of this. Even when God gets angry at Moses at this point, he doesn't do what pop culture seems to think that God is going to do all the time. Secondly, as we already indicated, it takes God a while to get angry. He's not immediately angry at Moses' questioning. It's only after Moses is shown that he is going to stubbornly refuse God's will. And at that point, when it is that clear, God begins to get angry. But he is slow to anger here. But why is God so upset? Well, part of it, obviously, is because Moses is refusing his will. But one thing you find out as you continue in the law and the specific laws about specific things, and as you continue in the prophets and the things that God is so upset about in the prophetic literature that people aren't doing, is that God cares deeply for the person who has no power. He cares deeply for the powerless and the oppressed. And he does not want them to be trampled on by people in power and people who are being unjust. And now it is not just anybody that that is true of. It is his chosen covenant people that are being trampled on by a bunch of pagans that he is trying to set free because he is trying to keep his covenant. And Moses is getting in the way. Moses is refusing to help God rescue his people. And in case after case after case in the Old Testament, God's anger arises out of his compassion to the mistreated. And that's really part of what's going on here too. He has compassion on the mistreated. And Moses doesn't want to help. But notice how this illustrates that God is slow to anger and God is short-lived in anger. And also that God is abounding in steadfast love as well. It's a constant companion with God being slow to anger, because this draws out of Exodus chapter 34 as well. This is a word that very frequently you'll hear preachers and teachers use the Hebrew word for, not because people like to spout Hebrew words, but because there's no good English equivalent for this word. You'll get translations like steadfast love or loving kindness or mercy typically in your English translations. And it means all of those things and more. It's a word that's rooted in the idea of covenant commitment and covenant loyalty as well. And it does reflect mercy and love and steadfastness and all of these kinds of things. And this word shows up all over the place. Some 250 times in the Old Testament, this word is used of God. You know, mean, vengeful, angry Old Testament God. 250 some times, He is a God of merciful, steadfast, covenant loyalty and love. That's who this God is in the Old Testament. Abounding in love. In fact, some 42 times we're told that His steadfast love endures forever. Also appearing in the history and in the poetry and in the prophecy. And you go back to that idea of His judgment will last to the third and fourth generation, but His mercy lasts for thousands of generations. And we sometimes get so hung up on the first part of that. How could He punish to the third and fourth generation and be fair? How could that be fair? Forget that for just one second. I mean, that's an interesting question. But His mercy abounds for thousands of generations. Have you ever stopped and thought about what that looks like on a calendar? I mean, if you take a low estimate of a generation being some 20 years, 1,000 generations, not thousands, but 1,000 generations covers all of human history to the beginning of civilization and then some. And we're not even close to wearing that out yet. This is the mercy and steadfast love of God. He is no God of anger and wrath and smiting. That's not at all how the Old Testament presents this God. When He does get angry, He gets angry for a reason. He gets there slowly. He gets over it quickly and turns back to the steadfast love that ultimately makes up His character. To which someone will inevitably say, well, wait a second, what about Uzzah? Here's the anger of God manifest. I mean, the Philistines had stolen the Ark of the Covenant in a war. They'd had it for a while. David finally gets it back from them, and he's returning it to his people. And there are these great festivities, this great celebration that comes with the Ark's return. Parade and dancing and music and just all sorts of celebrating. And the oxen that are pulling the cart that the Ark is on stumble. And the Ark begins to fall. And Uzzah heroically reaches up to steady it. And is struck down by God. And there are honest questions that come out of reading this scene. Isn't he doing a good thing? Would it have been better for the Ark to have fallen off the cart? Maybe broken? I mean, yeah, technically it's a breach of the law and all, but does it really require the death penalty? Isn't this just a bit too much? I mean, even David himself, a man after God's own heart, is angered by God's reaction at this point. Well, this, as we have said so frequently about these kinds of passages in the Old Testament, what it needs is better study. Not superficial study, not stereotypical study, not brushing it aside and pretending like it's not there, but actually thinking about what's going on here. And as we think about this, let me suggest to you a few things about this passage that are really important for us to understand. First of all, the law about how to transport the ark was clear. It was beyond clear. This is something that is from God's very law. This is not something that God had come up with like 15 minutes ago and maybe they forgot somehow. This is something that shows up in Exodus and Deuteronomy and twice in Numbers. And in fact, before this point, they'd never done it the wrong way. So it's not like the people of Israel did not know about this. You don't have, you know, one little clause of a sentence that's tucked away, buried somewhere in the, you know, priestly garment section of Leviticus that no one ever reads anyway. this is very practical. Everyone knows exactly what they're supposed to be doing, and they are willfully not doing what God wants them to do in this case. And one of the reasons why, we'll come to the other reason in a second, but one of the reasons why God had this law for them is because it was exceedingly dangerous, this Ark of the Covenant. This Ark had, in some sense, I mean, how exactly we quantify this, I can't begin to know, but in some sense, this Ark had the very presence of God upon it. And for the unholy to reach out and touch the presence of God is to invite death upon himself. You think of how everybody has always reacted when they come into the presence of God, and you can begin to get an idea. God tells Moses, "You can't see me and live." Everyone who sees just an angel falls down in fear before it. Isaiah sees a vision of God. "Woe is me, I am undone, because I'm a man of unclean lips." You're just going to reach out and touch God's presence? Now, these aren't just rules for the sake of rules. These are rules to protect humanity is what they are. Have you ever heard anyone complain about how needlessly strict and burdensome the rules for transporting plutonium are? How dare you come up with those Neanderthal rules to transport this plutonium? Who do you think you are? No, I don't know about you, but I'm pretty glad they have those rules about that. I don't want people just tossing that in their trunk and driving around with it. It's a terrible idea, and a lot of people would die, and we understand it. You know what? I hate to be trite, but God's a lot more powerful than plutonium is. And maybe there are good reasons for rules about how to transport his presence to keep us safe from his presence and what would happen to us if we came into his presence in any sort of literal way when we are completely unprepared for that. So there is the safety side of transporting God's ark, but beyond that, another piece of it is what it means, the ark itself. The ark was God's throne, is what it was. And the way that it was transported was the same way that kings were carried so frequently in the ancient world. The traveling throne of a king, what was called a litter of the king. He would sit up on the throne and they'd put it on poles and four people would carry the king around. That's what the Ark of the Covenant was. And they chucked it on a cart for an ox ride, is what they did. You stop and you think about that. These traveling thrones are for royalty, and carts were for things. You look through the Bible, and everywhere that carts are mentioned, they're carrying things. They're carrying equipment. They're carrying grain. They're carrying offerings to be sacrificed. And that's where they have put God in this story. It'd be like if you heard of a prisoner of war who had been rescued from your own hometown. And the city council decided to have a parade to celebrate his return home. And they tossed him in the trunk of your Crown Victoria and drove him down the street. How do you think he'd feel about that? Or maybe they're meeting with him before and saying, "Hey, here's what we're going to do." The whole city council is there, and they're meeting with this guy and says, "Hey, here's what we're going to do. We're thinking about the Crown Victoria. That's a bit rude, though. This guy over here has a Ford Explorer. It's got some windows. We'll chuck you in the cargo area of that so you can see a little bit better before we drive you through the parade." You think he might be a little bit insulted by that idea? You think he might be a little bit angered by that idea? That's what they have done with God, whose throne was the prisoner of war from the Philistines. And perhaps even worse than that, they seem to have gotten the idea from the Philistines, the first people to put the ark on a cart and drive it by animal. That's where their influence is coming from, not from the law of God. And so they're ignoring God's law, they're profaning God himself, and beyond that, it's a slap in the face of the relationship that they have with God. Because the ark doesn't just symbolize God's presence, and it's not just a figure of God's throne, it is also the ark of the covenant. And we forget that sometimes, even though that's the name of the thing. We call it that all the time, but we fail to remember that this is a symbol of their very relationship with God. It is this covenant that God has reached out, these promises that God has made and has sworn by an oath that He will keep for generations and generations to do good for this people. That's what they're chucking in the trunk as well. God's presence, God's throne, God's covenant. You think God might be legitimately upset at this? It's not just because Uzzah touched it. That's the culmination of everything that this entire scene has been building to. Here is a God who will not tolerate disrespect for His law, for His presence, and for His relationship with His people. And I don't know about you, but I would suggest that a God who doesn't care about those things isn't a God worth worshiping. If He doesn't care about Himself, why should I care about Him? If He doesn't care about His rules, why should I care about those? If God doesn't care about His relationship with me, why should I care about my relationship with Him? And God shows us in this one scene that He deeply cares about all of these things. And then you add to that the fact that the entire nation is watching at this celebration. If there is ever a moment to act to teach a lesson, this is that moment. Before, they had disrespected the ark. They'd treated it like some sort of lucky charm. They disobeyed God. And some 30,000 soldiers died. Now, one man dies. And you never again read of them treating the ark this way. Treating it the way they treated it when it got captured. Treating it the way they treated it on this very day. It was a profound lesson that taught an incredibly important point. And it's not teaching us that God is angry all the time. It's not teaching us that God just likes to smite people for the sake of smiting people. It's teaching us that God cares about His presence. He cares about His law. And He cares about His relationship with His people. And as we think about these sorts of things, let me offer you just a few basic thoughts to kind of wrap things up this afternoon. As we think about this idea of God being an angry God, ask the question, what is it that makes God angry? And two things stand out more than anything else as you work your way through the Old Testament. One is this idea of injustice and mistreatment of the weak and the downtrodden. That shows up over and over and over again as something that upsets God. And then secondly, this idea of a breakdown in relationship. That God cares enough about His covenant to get angry when people break it. And we understand that. We really do. Nobody has ever said the victim of adultery is reacting too much when she's angry with her unfaithful spouse. We understand what it is to be angry over a broken relationship, over a broken covenant. We get it. We really do. And in fact, anger is almost always the first step toward reconciliation. You can't fix the relationship if the other person doesn't even care. And you're going to be angry if you care. So the anger has to be there if it's ever going to be solved at all. So what is it that makes God angry? Understand those things first. And you can better understand God's anger in the Bible. Secondly, I would emphasize the consistent biblical picture about sin and what sin results in. And the consistent biblical teaching is that the wages of sin is death. There's no question about that in the Bible. There's no room for debating that in the Bible. If you sin, what you deserve is death. Now, in reality, immediate physical death doesn't very frequently happen. That doesn't mean it's not what we deserve. It just means it's not what frequently happens. And so when it does, it shocks us. These stories really should be a reminder to us that death is a natural consequence of sin. What they should be is a call for us to take far more seriously sin than we usually do. But instead, we read these stories and we think God is mean. Punishment is delayed daily in our lives, weekly in our lives, constantly in our lives. And instead of that delayed punishment reminding us that God is slow to anger, somehow we turn that into thinking that we don't really deserve to die. These stories should remind us constantly that because we are sinners, we deserve to die. And praise God for His slowness to anger, that He is abounding in steadfast love toward us. Let's let these stories shake us back into the reality that doesn't take God's mercy for granted. Because great is His faithfulness to us, even when we are not faithful to Him. If you'll turn in your songbooks to number 190, we'll sing this song now as we reflect on who our God is. A God who is slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. A God who is faithful to us, even though we fail Him so frequently. If there's some way that we can help you make your life right with God or begin a journey with Him, anything that we can do for you, won't you let that be known as we stand and sing together.